All right, so last week we began to kind of discuss, and long last what we're saying is the real issue. The real question is not whether or not we can feel that we have the New Testament as it was written, because 85% of 5,000 manuscripts that we have are identical to one another in the wording. And among the 15% where there's differences in the wording, most of them are obvious, easily correctable spelling errors and other accidental mistakes that anyone would recognize if you were trained in the Greek language, just like you would be able to recognize grammatical or skip lines or missing words, et cetera, in English. And so there's no question as to whether or not we have the New Testament as it was originally written. But the real pressing question here is, what about the small fraction of that 15%? So a fraction of a fraction where there might be differences in wording that could potentially amount to very important doctrinal statements one way or the other that could impact what we believe based on the wording in those few verses as it appears in one manuscript versus another. And so we said one of the key questions here is sort of explaining how you get these wording differences where there might be potential doctrine at stake. And, you know, can they be explained as accidents? Or is it better to possibly interpret some of them potentially as intentional changes made to the text? That's why we have two different versions of some verses in the New Testament. Maybe, just maybe, somebody intentionally made a change to the text. So we looked and saw that there's historic records among the early Christians saying that Gnostic heretics, including some that were in Alexandria, were deliberately making changes to the wording in the documents of the New Testament as those Gnostic heretics made their own copies. Is it possible that as Christians continue to make more and more copies at this time in the first 2-3 centuries, that one of or more of the copies that they acquired as faithful Christians happened to have been a copy that had been altered partially by a Gnostic and therefore accidentally incorporated some deliberate changes made by the Gnostics? And we said that we think that a reasonable analysis has to consider that when you look at some of these passages. And our primary example that we started in with last week was John 1:18, where we have the phrase, in the Alexandrian manuscripts, it says the only begotten God. In the Byzantine manuscripts, it says only begotten Son. And so, which is correct? We said that there's obviously a potential at least, doctrinal statement that's being made there that's different from what's considered Orthodox Christianity if you have the phrase only begotten God. And if that phrase is interpreted to suggest that this is a second God from the Father, a God that was begotten from the Father, if that phrase means that, it would be of enormous doctrinal importance. And so if it's only begotten Son, then it doesn't suggest that there are two gods, doesn't suggest that there was a God who was reproduced in any sense from the Father as a divine being. And so we began to look at a couple of authors, Tim Warner, who says that yes, tampering is possible. It's possible that the reading that we have that says only begotten God in the Alexandrian text is a result of deliberate tampering. And Dr. James White, who says no, he thinks it's just an honest mistake that we have these two different options, whether it's the word God or the word Son, and he doesn't see it as being very doctrinally significant. So we began to look at the evidence in terms of this, and we said that there's an early Gnostic by the name of Valentinus and his followers who were in Alexandria that we know were making changes to the text based on the words of early Christians who said they were doing so. So we know that Gnostics in Alexandria were making changes to the text based on what the early Christians said. Some of those Gnostics were Valentinus and his followers. Also, we know that in general, some of the Gnostics taught that they used this Greek term monogenes, which in the English is the word only begotten, And they use that title, monogenes, as a title for a specific, separate divine being in the Gnostic scheme. So in the Gnostic scheme, there's this supreme being that they called Praetor or Proarch, Bythus. They had several different names for him, but that was the supreme being. And in their view, monogenes was an offspring of his. And so they were using the term monogenes. The term monogenes isn't a problem. It's just we want to be aware of when the Gnostics use the term monogenes, they meant it as reference to a separate divine being who was the offspring, literally in some way, of a more advanced, more supreme divine being. And then when we looked at Ptolemy, who was a follower of Valentinus, and we saw Ptolemy describing, commenting on John chapter 1, and he quotes from Valentinus regarding John chapter 1, 14, which is just a few verses before John chapter 1, 18. And Valentinus and Ptolemy used the phrase only begotten God, showing that they, as Gnostics, had a preference for that phrase. And when they interpreted that phrase, they interpreted it as consistent with the Gnostic view that monogenes was a separate God who was an offspring of the Supreme Being. So we've shown that there is a, certainly the Gnostics liked this phrase. Certainly they interpreted it in terms of their own doctrine. Certainly there were Gnostics who were making changes to the text. Some of them were Valentinus and his followers. So there's really good historical case to say this is certainly possible that these guys made this change and that's why we find it in Alexandrian texts, accidentally incorporated into what we see today in some traditions, in some manuscripts. So I want to talk about some of the problems with Dr. White's interpretation. Remember, Dr. White says it's not really doctrinally significant. In his view, he interprets this phrase, monogenes theos, which in the English would be only begotten God. In his view, that simply means the unique God. And so he doesn't view it as a statement about a God who's begotten from another God. He doesn't see it as a statement about there being a second God. He sees it as simply a statement about the uniqueness of God, the only God.
So he's changing the word from the typical concept that the Greek word has, has to do with reproductivity, to a word that simply has to do with uniqueness.
Right. So the question is, can you take monogenes, which is so often in English translated at least to only begotten, and say, well, it doesn't mean anything to do with begetting or reproduction or offspring. It only has to do with uniqueness, one of a kind. Monogenes, one of a kind. Can it be interpreted solely to mean one of a kind? And so I want to talk about some of the evidence for and against that and some of the problems with it. So
the reason this is significant is because if you want to dismiss the possibility that this particular Alexandrian wording is potentially inherited from changes made by Gnostics, you have to come up with a natural explanation for how this accidentally, or how this either is no real problem and doesn't have Gnostic potential, Gnostic doctrinal significance to it. And so White is sidestepping this by saying, in his view, he's saying, well, monogenes doesn't actually speak of the idea of God being begotten. It just means he's the only God. And so what we're going to do is analyze the words and his assessment of it to see if that's fair.
So I think it probably should be stated for clarity that in our understanding, and I think the traditional Christian understanding, the phrase only begotten is applied to the person of Jesus Christ with regard to his incarnation. In other words, the person of Jesus Christ exists long before the incarnation, in our view, forever before the incarnation. He's always existed because he's God. He's never had a starting point. He doesn't have a creation point. He doesn't have a point where some other being bursts him into existence. He's always existed. And the only reason and the only way that the term only begotten is applied to him is when he becomes incarnate as a man. And then you refer to that incarnation using the term only begotten. So for us, we apply the title only begotten not to refer to his coming into existence, but his acquiring a human nature, becoming human. And so if you look here and what Dr. White's saying, that monogenes essentially means one of a kind, is that possible? Is that fair to strip that language, strip that wording of the idea of
offspring,
of being born? Remember when we say the incarnation, Jesus was born, he was conceived in the womb of Mary, he was born as a man. So we can use that phrase in that sense with regard to the incarnation. But can you strip that Greek term of that idea of begetting, of birthing, of reproduction? So if you look elsewhere in the New Testament, let's set aside all the places where this term is used to refer to Jesus, and let's look at all the other places it's used. This Greek word monogenes. New Testament passages where monogenes is used, where Jesus is not in view, show that monogenes refers to the relationship of a parent to their child, especially an only child, but not always an only child. It can be a child with a unique relationship to the parent, distinct from other children. But it always has that parent-child relationship in view. Isaac's relationship to his father Abraham is one of the examples, probably the primary example. We know that Abraham had other children, Ishmael for one. But Isaac is the monogenes of Abraham in the sense that he has this unique relationship to his father. But notice it's inherently a parent-child relationship. They don't just have a relationship. Isaac isn't one of a kind only. He's not the only offspring. He's got a unique relationship, but it's a father-son relationship. That much is clear. So in that sense, it can convey the uniqueness of the child, but it can't. It always refers to them as a child in some way.
Meaning you never see monogenes used to refer to uniqueness apart from a parent-child relationship.
Right.
It's not, it doesn't have the similarity to the English word unique. It has to be similar to the English concept of the only child. They're the only child. The only son, the only daughter. That kind of only child is the way monogenes is used, never just uniqueness.
Right. So since we see it used that way elsewhere in the New Testament when it's not describing Jesus, when we then take the same word and apply it to Jesus, we shouldn't radically change its meaning and strip it of the essential component of the father-son, parent-child relationship that it conveys. Yes, it means one of a kind, but it means one of a kind in the sense of a lineage of offspring. When we look at the word monogenes as applied to Jesus, particularly in John's writings, we see that monogenes, in the case of Jesus, monogenes refers to the relationship that Jesus has to the Father through the incarnation. And so it refers to, for example, John 1:14. Again, just four verses earlier, we find monogenes used by John, the exact same author, and he uses it with regard to the incarnation. I'm going to try and pull this up just so we can read 1:14. Sure, I get the... do that. Sorry, just a second here while I pull this up. John 1:14 says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us." So notice that this, starting off by introducing us to the idea of the incarnation, "The Word was made flesh. We beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father," the monogenes of the Father. Right? When John introduces this term, before he gets to verse 18, in verse 14, he's using monogenes in regard to the incarnation and the incarnation's relationship between the Father and the Word. It's inherently related to their parent, offspring, through the incarnation, that relationship. Inherently. So when you fast forward four verses and you see monogenes again, you can't then strip out the concept of father-son. It's just contextually not feasible. All right, let's see what else. So if you then put the parent-child back in, instead of just saying unique, if it means unique child, unique offspring, and then you attach that to God, then you're back in potential hot water. Because
attach
now you,
to the word God.
Right, because then you've got only begotten God in the sense of not just unique God, but only begotten God. Does that convey the idea of a God who was born, who was procreated by another divine being? So it gets to the idea of whether or not Jesus, the Word of God, is a son through the incarnation only, or whether or not his existence as a divine being also is explained in terms of being an offspring, as a divine offspring. When we talk about through the incarnation, we mean he's a son through his humanity. He becomes, it's not his divine nature that's conceived in the womb of Mary. It's not his divine nature that's born from Mary. Yes, the divine nature is there. But what's coming into existence is his humanity in the conception and in the birth. So, should we apply that to his divine nature as well? And I think that's the potential implications that the phrase only begotten God would have.
And here we're also offering up exegetical reasons from John 1 for why you would not expect to find monogenes coupled with theos for God. You would instead expect it, as we'll see here in a second, to be coupled with sonship through the incarnation, because that's what John 1 is describing. In the beginning, the Word was God. Fast forward, the Word becomes incarnate, becomes flesh, the only monogenes of the Father, who reveals the Father to us, the monogenes huios of the Father, right? So you're constantly, he's inferring that all of this is only about the incarnation, not about his being God, born as a God, but born as a man.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't expect it to see coupled with God. You would expect to see it coupled with man.
Now, you know, when Dr. White breaks this word down, because it's a compound word, just like only begotten has got only and begotten, monogenes is two different words in Greek put together essentially to form a compound word. And this word genes comes from genos, which means kind, essentially. So he's correct that it means kind, but we're saying it always means kind in the sense of offspring relationship to the parent. Never separated from that. And we think it's unfair for him to try and separate it from that. And beyond just the other New Testament evidence when it's not applied to Jesus, beyond the way John uses it in John 1:14, which both show the parent-child relationship is in view, we can also look at other examples outside of the New Testament. I mean, there's many documents in ancient times written in Greek, biblical New Testament Greek, so we can look and see how they use it. And, you know, it's not 100%, but when we look at it, we see, once again, that this parent-child relationship is in view very, very often.
Whenever monogenes is used.
When monogenes is used. So here's some examples. I'm just going to hit the highlights. There's a Greek writer by the name of Hesiod.
I wouldn't do this.
Don't need to get this.
State it.
Multiple times here you can see, I'm going to read some of what they're saying. An only child, she is the mother's only child. There should be an only son. So frequently they're using monogenes in ancient Greek to have this relationship. The next thing we're going to talk about is, yes, you can break monogenes down into mono and genos, but you could also break it down into the related word mono and genomai, because genomai is a verb. And so typically verbs form part of the root concept of words. And so when we look at genomai as opposed to just looking at genos, we look and we see that the New Testament lexicon state that actually that monogenes is derived from monos and genomai rather than just monos and genos. So limiting our interpretation just to genos is in part unfairly narrowing it just to one of those two words to inform us about the meaning of monogenes. And we look at genomai, we see that it conveys the idea as well of the parent-child relationship. I think I've already pointed out that John 1, this is an additional aspect. John 1 uses the word father twice, both in verse 14 and verse 18. So if John was intending to use this word monogenes, which elsewhere refers to parent-child relationships, but John intended to use it just to mean unique without talking about parent-child relationships, why does he keep using the word father? Doesn't make sense. Let's see. In addition, I think it's... we'll skip that part. Also, it's worth noting that the Alexandrian reading, monogenes theos, the only begotten God, that reading which appears in the Alexandrian manuscripts, appears nowhere else in the New Testament. You do see Jesus described as the only begotten Son other places in the New Testament, but you don't find the phrase only begotten God anywhere else, which I think is another circumstantial piece of evidence that says this is likely to be a novel phrase potentially created by intentional tampering with the text, because you don't see it everywhere.
It doesn't seem like the normal way New Testament writers use this term refer to Jesus. They typically use it to refer to Jesus in every other case, to refer to his sonship as a man to God the Father through the incarnation. They never couple it with God, with the phrase theos or God, ever.
Yep.
So in these Alexandrian copies, monogenes huios is used multiple times outside of here?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Normally, it's no.
This is the only place in any copy that we see monogenes God.
Yeah.
And only Alexandrian.
Only Alexandrian and John 1:18.
Yeah.
In all other cases, even in the Alexandrian, it's always monogenes.
So you see how that would it doesn't prove the case by any means, but it would lend itself to the idea of people going through making copies. The New Testament's a large document, and they've made this change in this one place without having the advantage of a Google search to go, where else do I find monogenes son so I can make the change everywhere? They make it in this one place in this critical passage in John. And so what we're offering up is, one, the use of this term in the New Testament when it's not applied to Jesus. Number two, the contextual usage in John, where he uses the word Father repeatedly, and particularly when he introduces this word monogenes. Number three, the usage outside the New Testament, which frequently enjoins this word to refer to parent-child relationships. And number four, the fact that this reading, the only begotten God, is the only time that that phrase occurs in any manuscript is right here, which means it's a sort of unique occurrence. It's not consistent with the language we see elsewhere in the New Testament.
It's a peculiar phrasing.
Yeah. So all of those things, I think, provide a reasonable case to conclude. But if there's that much sort of like good, reasonable basis to say monogenes God should be regarded with some suspicion, why would we choose that phrasing? Why do some scholars choose that phrasing still? Why not just go with the more consistent, familiar, usual New Testament phrase, monogenes son, which we see elsewhere throughout the New Testament, and we see throughout all the Byzantine documents that have John 1:18. Why not just go with that? And the typical answer, the primary answer, the really only answer, is because the oldest manuscripts that we have today have monogenes God, only begotten God,
in John
1:18. So we'll get to that in a second. Now, before we get to that, I want to say, as Scott put in here, I think responsibly in the study, on balance, it's possible, we keep using the phrase as possible potential, even if the phrase originally read only begotten God, it still wouldn't necessarily have to be a heretical doctrine or a statement that the Word was himself born as a divine being from another divine being. There's ways to interpret it that could avoid that idea of divine procreation. And we see that in a couple other translations which say God the only Son, that say we're going to include the idea of parent-son in here, so it's essentially saying God the only Son. Yes, theos is in there, but monogenes conveys the sonship. And so still identifying him as God, but saying he's the only.
It would be like saying the phrase God the Father and God the only Son.
Right. Doesn't mean they're two different gods. It just means the phrase Father and the phrase only begotten Son are intended to distinguish these persons inside the single divine being. So it's possible. But again, I don't think we need to go there because I think when we get to this fundamental argument that the earliest copies that we have today of the New Testament contain the phrase only begotten God in John 1:18, well, why not go with it since it's the earliest? The argument here is if the earliest copies we have the phrase only begotten God, then doesn't that mean that that phrase is present earlier historically, closer to the originals, and therefore more likely to be what was in the originals? If we have something else later, doesn't the fact that it comes later indicate that it was probably changed afterwards accidentally or whatever to say only begotten Son? So what we want to do here is say, well, it's sort of a misleading argument when people point to the fact that the earliest copies that we have
that survive
say only begotten God for a couple reasons. First of all, let's look at the dates. The text that we have before the 5th century that have this phrase only begotten God are a document called P66, which was written somewhere between 150 and 175 AD.
It's a fragment of John's Gospel, and I think Luke maybe.
P75, which was dated to around 200 AD. Another document called Vaticanus, or B, which is dated to around 325 to 350. So notice the jump. We've gone from right around 150 to 200 AD for the first two documents. Now we're up to after the year 300. Now we're at 325 to 350 AD for Vaticanus, or B. And then finally this document called Sinaiticus.
It's one of the codexes.
Or Aleph, which is 330 to 360. So let's say we've got these two different groups. Those are the four documents. They all say monogenes God. Doesn't that show pretty unanimously that that was the earliest reading of this text? Well, the problem is, remember, we don't have all the texts written or all the copies made at this point in time or before it. We just randomly have these four. And they come out of this place called Alexandria, probably surviving because the climate's better, or based on copies that came out of Alexandria because the climate was better. It's just sort of happenstance that we have these four. There's other ancient documents that we also can look at.
Even so, if that's all we had, and we have at random four early surviving documents from the 2nd century to the 4th century, and all four happen to have monogenes God, you would go, well, if at random you got four and they all agreed, that's a pretty good case that seemed to be the norm.
Yes, under normal circumstances.
You're not taking into account the fact that we do have other records of New Testament readings, just not in copies of the New Testament, but in quotations of the New Testament, which is what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so there's a couple other things that we want to sort of identify. Let's see, I think did I move ahead on accident here? Okay, no, we're good. And that is translations of the New Testament, because up to this point, we talk about those four that I just mentioned, they're all Greek copies. What about translations into other languages? What do they say? When do they date? Are they before or after these four documents? What about people who are quoting the New Testament? It's not a copy of the New Testament, but they're doing like we would do in one of our documents, where we're making an argument, somewhere in their argument, we quote a portion of the New Testament. It's not a copy of the New Testament. It's not a copy of the book of John, but it quotes the book of John. Who wrote those? When were they written? What do they say? And also there's the issue of geography. If I present to you multiple people writing in different locations around the ancient world that have a phrase, that suggests that that phrase was fairly universal at that point in time. And so we're going
to
look...
Compared to an alternate that's unique to one specific area.
Right. So if we got four documents, theoretically, that come out of Alexandria, and they all have the phrase, only begotten God, but we have other documents from the same period of time, which all say, only begotten Son.
From around the world.
And those documents are from around the world, and they date to the same period of time. What does that do for the earliness argument? It shows you that in order for multiple people in different locations to have the phrase only begotten Son at the same time as these four Alexandrian documents are written, they must have had documents that said only begotten Son. So the phrase would be, those phrases would be just as early as one another, and the earliness argument would disappear. Yeah.
I think you can think of it, you know, this way. So we have fragments of copies of the New Testament, like P66, P75. You have entire copies of the New Testament, like Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. And then, you know, Brian said we have these quotes. Well, a quote of John 1:18 in an early Christian writer who's writing a letter to Corinth is essentially a fragment of John's Gospel. He's quoting, he's got a copy of just John 1:18 in his letter. It's a fragmentary quote of a portion of John's Gospel, written by a Christian author in another document that's not a copy of the New Testament, but nonetheless has a fragment from a particular date. And that's what we're going to be looking at, is comparing these other fragmentary, essentially, copies or quotes.
So obviously, you know, if you look at Christians writing in the first four centuries, because that's our window, the earliest document that said only begotten God dated around 150 AD. The last one of the four that we looked at dated to 360 AD. So within that 200-year time frame, we got a lot of Christians writing and quoting the New Testament. A number of them don't quote John 1:18, so they're going to be useless for our purposes. Some of them use the phrase only begotten God, but they don't quote from John 1:18 specifically. Some of them use the phrase only begotten Son because they're quoting some other portion of the New Testament which has that phrase, not John 1:18. But the ones we particularly want to look at are the ones that do quote John 1:18.
It is important to point out that even the authors who don't quote John 1:18, who do use only begotten Son, don't seem to know of or ever use the phrase only begotten God.
Right.
So they would seem to have known about it if that was in the earlier documents. It's possible that they knew about it and they didn't use it. But right. Again, it's a testimony that potentially they did not know of that phrasing in their documents.
So let's look at a fellow by the name of Irenaeus, who we talk about quite a bit around here. It's important to note, first of all, the date that he's writing is around 170 to 180 AD. So this is right within the exact same couple of decades that earliest Alexandrian document or copy is alleged to have been written. Irenaeus is a parallel source at the same time. He's up in Lyons, France, by the way, as opposed to Alexandria, Egypt. But what does he have? And second of all, it's important to note that Irenaeus is a disciple. He was taught by a guy named Polycarp, and Polycarp was himself not only taught by John the Apostle, who wrote John's Gospel, but Polycarp was appointed to be a bishop by John.
And Polycarp was the bishop in the church of Smyrna, where John sent the letter of one of the letter versions of the copy of the book of Revelation. So it's clear that Polycarp received documents written by John's own hand, copies of documents written by John's own hand, not necessarily the book of John's Gospel, but quite possibly he was, as a person appointed by John, among the community people who had access to early copies of John's works.
So there's three quotes we have from Irenaeus in which he quotes John 1:18. The last of which some people regard as being what they call spurious, which means they believe that someone inserted this into Irenaeus' writings. And the reason that they think the last of the three is potentially sort of added into by somebody else is because it's inconsistent with the other two quotes. So we have three quotes, two of them are phrased one way, the last one's phrased the other way. Makes you think that maybe the last one was possibly somebody made a change or inserted it in there. It's not the original. But in any case, here's what we find. In two of the places that he quotes John 1:18, he uses the phrase only begotten Son.
The first two times he uses the phrase only begotten Son.
The last time he uses the phrase only begotten God. Now, at the best, if you assume all three phrases are authentically written by Irenaeus, it shows that in the year 170 to 180, he's aware of both wordings. So, which wording is earlier historically? You can't say. All you can say is that by Irenaeus' time, both wordings of John 1:18 were available. So you can't say that the only begotten God is the earliest wording that we find historically anymore. Because it's simply not. Where would Irenaeus have found a copy that said only begotten Son in 170 to 180? He didn't likely have the original copy of John's Gospel written over 70 years earlier. He had a copy. He had a copy that said only begotten Son that was probably written sometime before 170 AD. And it made its way to France. That means there was a copy that said only begotten Son that's at least as old as the oldest Alexandrian text that says only begotten God. Has to be, historically. So it's simply false to say because the earliest surviving copy of the Gospel of John or fragment of the Gospel of John says only begotten God, that that's the earliest one historically that we see. False. Both of them have equal antiquity. They both date to the same time because of these quotes we find from people like Irenaeus.
But there's nothing in the context of the quotes. I didn't read them all the way. But the
only important thing.
What is he discussing?
The only important thing here is that he is clearly quoting John 1:18. And the reading of it that he provides is only begotten son in the first two versions at least. So he at least knew that that version was present in some of the readings of John's gospel at his time. So that's the only thing that we're really interested in here.
The next guy,
any commentary or anything like that?
He doesn't comment on the issues that we're engaging in here in those quotes. The next guy is a fellow named Clement of Alexandria. Notice again, he's in Alexandria. So this is an interesting question because it says, well, all the copies that we have, the Alexandrian type, in these two centuries, they all say only begotten God. Maybe is that the only version that the Alexandrians know? It's not, though, because Clement, notice that Clement's writing between 150 and 215 AD, once again, smack dab right in the time of this earliest Alexandrian manuscript, and when Clement quotes John 1:18. He says, only begotten Son, only begotten Son. He says, only begotten God once. He says, only begotten Son. So three out of four times he says, only begotten Son. So here's a guy in Alexandria writing at the same time that earliest Alexandrian document was written, and he's aware that John 1:18, there's copies that say, only begotten Son. Where did he get that copy? Somebody must have made a copy that made its way into his hands by 150 to 215 that had John 1:18 in it and said only begotten Son.
And it could have been an Alexandrian copy.
Right. It could have been an Alexandrian copy that said only begotten Son.
Yeah. As opposed to Byzantine.
Hippolytus, again, writing between 170 and 235, uses the phrase only begotten Son when he quotes John 1:18. Tertullian, writing in 200, says, only begotten Son. Even Origen, who is a heretic, when he writes from 185 to 254, and he's quoting the John 1:18, he says, only begotten Son. He's writing out of Egypt. So the Egyptians in this era had copies that said, only begotten Son, not only begotten God. Both versions existed as the earliest time that we can date either version.
Yeah. And if you add these up, and you know, of course, we included four documents that support the Alexandrian reading, only begotten God. The last two were both written in the 300s. That's Codex Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Here we're quoting people earlier than that, and Brian's got more in the list here. But if you were to add both the fragmentary copies that are of the Alexandrian type, and then these fragmentary quotations that are in these other persons in Alexandria and around the world, you can see that there's even more attestation of only begotten Son than there is for only begotten God in the ancient fragmentary documentation, whether those are copies of the New Testament or quotes of the New Testament or fragments.
This is why this argument about the Alexandrian are older than the earliest Byzantines is kind of a misleading argument, because obviously Irenaeus and Clement and Tertullian, who are all writing from different locations, all had a Byzantine wording of John 1:18 at the same time period or earlier than some of these four earliest Alexandrian copies that survive to this day. So there's no question that Byzantine rendering of John 1:18 is as old as the Alexandrian rendering. It has to be, because we have people quoting it at the same period of time. We can go forward. I'm not going to read them all.
You can see there's a long list
John Chrysostom, Ambrose, Augustine, guys that we don't like for their doctrinal views, but when they quote it, they say only begotten Son. Now, there are some in this list who also say only begotten God, but that just shows you that both versions of this existed in these same two centuries at the earliest period of time. You can't say which one is the earliest, because they're both there. So Athanasius also, he's a bishop of Alexandria. He's writing from 273 to 326. He says only begotten Son. So on and on and on. I won't get into the rest of this stuff. Next, we're going to look at the Latin Vulgate, which we mentioned before. It's a Latin translation of the New Testament. And there's some interesting stuff here, because it's written by a guy named Jerome. It's translated by a guy named Jerome, I should say, in 382 AD. So this is just decades after the last of those four Alexandrian documents. Right? The latest one dated from like 330 to 360 AD of those four early Alexandrian ones that say only begotten God. So Jerome is writing within a couple decades to translate from Greek into Latin. And we're not going to see monogenes theos or monogenes huios in Jerome's writing here because that's Greek and he's writing in Latin. So we're going to see the Latin equivalent, which is, and my Latin pronunciation is worse than my Greek, unigenitus filius.
There you go, probably close.
Probably close. What we do is going to be probably close, keyword being close. But you can see the similar, you know, right? You got monogenes in Greek, you got uni genitus in Latin. Same thing, only begotten. But the word filius in Latin is the word son. That's what we're going to see in Jerome. So here, Scott actually has the text from Jerome up at the top. I'm not going to attempt to read that, but you can see that it's John 1:18 in his Latin translation of John's Gospel, 382 AD, and it says only begotten son. What copy did Jerome have? Jerome didn't just have this. Some guy wasn't like, it's 381 AD, I got to finish this Greek copy that I got to get over to Jerome. So Jerome's copy in Greek that he's translating from was written in 381. He probably had a copy that was at least somewhat closer to the time of this latest of those four Alexandrian documents that we saw. Now, actually, Jerome tells us a little bit about his work. He comments on this effort he has to translate into Latin, why he's translating it. And it's interesting what he says, and I'll kind of highlight as we look at his words here. He says, he's talking about other people who have urged him to make this translation into Latin. He says, "You urge me to make a new work from the old work." Meaning, the new work is the Latin, the old is the Greek. "And that I might sit as a kind of judge over the versions of Scripture dispersed throughout the whole world." So in 382, he's already aware that there's different wording in some of the passages in Scripture, dispersed throughout the world. He says, "And that I might resolve which among such vary and which of these they may be which truly agree with the Greek," by which he means the original Greek. Right? So part of his purpose here is not just translation, but to create a copy that is the best, most authentic, most likely, or at least the understood to be original wording. And in that regard, we already know what he thinks John 1:18's original wording was. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that he may have had documents available to him in that day that we don't have today.
He's a much better position than English scholars of Greek today to decide what the original Greek version was based upon the availability of Greek documents in the 3rd and 4th century.
He may have had a bunch of documents that existed from earlier times that did not survive from Jerome to us, but survived from earlier copies to Jerome, and maybe he had documents that were copies that dated to the times of some of these earliest Alexandrian ones. We don't know. When he was trying to figure this out, and he was collecting copies, he determined that the correct reading was only begotten son. He goes, go ahead.
The Vulgate doesn't have a bibliography.
No, I don't know. He says, "If our truth is to be a seeking among many, why do we not now return to the Greek originals to correct those mistakes, which either through faulty translators were set forth, or through confident but unskilled were wrongly revised?" So notice that he's saying there may have been people who deliberately made changes. Now, he's not saying that it was necessarily malevolent. Maybe they were doing what he's trying to do, which is we've got different wording in certain places. They're trying to get to the correct one. He's saying part of our job here, he's saying part of his job is to figure out which was the original. Or through sleeping scribes, either were added or changed. He says, "I now speak of the New Testament, which is undoubtedly Greek, except the Apostle Matthew," he says, "which was originally in Hebrew." He says, "This Testament certainly differs in our language and is led in a way to different streams. It is necessary to seek the single fountainhead." So he's trying to correct the types of problems we have today. Which is correct? The Alexandrian only begotten God or the Byzantine only begotten son? He's saying he's dealing with the same problem, much earlier than we are, and he's saying the correct version is only begotten
Son. So you gotta read the last paragraph.
He says, this present preface promises only the four Gospels, the order of which is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, revised in comparison with only old Greek books. He's looking at old in his day.
Old.
In his day, they're old. What's old? 5 years? You think Jerome is collecting documents that were written within 5 years? He's collecting the oldest documents he can lay his hands on. We don't have those documents today. We just have four random copies that come out of Alexandria. He's got other documents than we don't have. And he's saying of collecting the only old Greek documents, that the correct reading of John 1:18 is only begotten Son. Now, how can somebody come in and say, well, P66, the oldest one we have, 150 to 200 AD, says only begotten God. That's the earliest. It must be the original. How can you, if you make that argument, you must either not be informed of the other issues or you're deliberately skewing the perspective based on the argument. It's not to say that they're wrong. It's just to say that's not a convincing argument. And he concludes by saying only those in which the sense will have been changed, we're correcting. So he's correcting those where he's determined that there's been a change in some of the copies. Correcting it back to what the oldest consistent Greek copy said at his day. I'm not going to talk about the Peshitta. I'm just going to pass on that. Some of these others. You have a list of summary documents here, but they were supposed to be color-coded originally. I couldn't find a document that had the color coding in it, but it's, in any case, a summary of the stuff we just...
Probably color-coded online.
Oh, no, it wasn't. But in any case, it's just a summary of the things we just discussed. So if we kind of keep scrolling down here, we have a few more minutes. I think we'll be able to finish up this study largely here.
Yeah, remember we said of all the 15% of the New Testament that has got some kind of wording variation, and most of those things are spelling errors or skipped lines or wrong words, only a fragment of that has any potential doctrinal significance. And the reason that we're going to point out here, we looked at John 1:18 as the primary example. Here are a survey of the other most potentially important doctrinally significant. You'll see that the total number of passages to look at here is around four. Four verses out of the entire New Testament that could potentially have wording changes that have any doctrinal significance.
So notice,
not much.
And it's not even that, because one of them doesn't really. But
right.
So notice that we had a document, an Alexandrian document called P66, which was dated to around 150 to 175 AD. The second one, the next oldest, was P77, which was around 200 AD. So of those two, the only one that's earlier than the year 200 is P66. That's a single Alexandrian copy that says only begotten God before the year 200. But we have Irenaeus in France, Hippolytus, who's in Rome, and Clement of Alexandria, who's in Egypt, all of whom have copies in the same period before the year 200 that say only begotten Son. There's no way you can argue that the only copy, the only wording that was available in 150 AD was only begotten God. There's no way you can argue that point. Historically, it's false. Both translations already existed. Both wording already existed, I should say. Yeah.
You just need to probably keep moving.
I'm just seeing how much of this... I'm skimming through stuff that I think we've already covered. I'm just looking at
I'm down here at 1 Timothy 3:16.
Okay, let's see that. So we're only going to hit the highlights on these, obviously. These are a couple other passages that people should be aware of in terms of where there's potential doctrinal wording differences. One of them is 1 Timothy 3:16, which in the Byzantine family of copies includes the words, or has the words, God was manifest in the flesh. The Alexandrian copies say he appeared in a body. Now, if you know anything about Gnostic doctrine and early heretical views, some of them taught that the Word of God, Jesus Christ, didn't actually become a human being. He simply appeared or looked like one for a while. And so, if Timothy actually is saying he appeared in a body, it could lend itself, soften up, a little bit and make way for that heretical view. Doesn't necessarily get you all the way there, because it's still fairly close to the phrase, God was manifest in the flesh.
And also, we have so many other attestations clearly in the New Testament that Jesus was actually born. But what this would do is show you, again, that the Alexandrian have places where the heretics at some point may have said, I don't like the way this is said, may alter a little bit, and that might have found its way later into copies made by pious scribes, and this may be the case here in Timothy.
In this one, it's worth noting that Dr. White and Tim Warner both prefer the Byzantine reading on this passage. Yeah. Next one is Mark 16. Some people already, probably in this group, everybody's aware of this, but the last 11 verses of Mark 16 are not present in some of the earliest manuscripts of Mark's Gospel. In other words, Mark's Gospel in some old manuscripts ends at verse 8 and doesn't have verses 9 through 20. So that includes the Alexandrian codices of Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, which don't have those final 11 verses. Here it's kind of a wash, because what's contained in those final verses is largely things that we see elsewhere in the New Testament. So even if you said we're not going to include those as authentic, you would still have the content doctrinally of those verses elsewhere. It wouldn't be lost. So it's not like we have something unique stated there that's said nowhere in the New Testament. It would be like a verse that you say, well, this wasn't in here originally, and it says God the Father. We have the phrase God the Father a lot of other places in the New Testament, so removing it from one verse doesn't remove that doctrine. It's kind of the same thing here with the content of these 11 verses. The last one is John 5, 1 John 5:7, so John's epistle, and it's a part of verse 7 known as the Johannine comma, which I really don't think we need to spend much time on. What do you think really needs to be stated about this? It's another instance where, essentially, if this phrase was in the original, it would be hands down the unchallengeable articulation of the doctrine of the Trinity that no one could contest. If you remove it and say it's not in the original, you don't lose the doctrine of the Trinity. You just essentially lose a phrase which summarizes it in about 10 words or less. So you're not losing the doctrine again. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't impact overall Christian doctrine, essentially.
Yeah, this is not, with the exception of John 1:18 and 1 Timothy 3, none of the other ones that we've missed here, which are only two, are potentially adding something heretical or taking something out that's important that isn't found elsewhere in the New Testament or in the Bible. These are just a couple of places where there's some words that aren't often in some of the earlier manuscripts. And so should they be included or not? Were these added later? Where did they come from? Why were they not in some of the manuscripts or fragments? That's really the only question, but there isn't anything really here of doctrinal significance that's lost if you don't include them, so
yeah,
it's not as big of a deal.
Right.
So again, the reason that we bring these up, these four instances up, is these really are the sum total of passages where you might want to know what's going on there, and just to say that there's such a small percentage of the New Testament, only four verses or passages, we might say, where there's anything of question whether it should be in there or worded slightly differently, whether it matters at all. So the rest of it, the other 99.something% is, we can be 100% confident that that is what the authors originally wrote, what John wrote, what Mark wrote, what Paul wrote.
I'll say that, you know, with regard to Mark 16, Byzantine texts support this, and we've seen other ways that we are able to affirm the authenticity and accuracy of the Byzantine texts, even though they date later in terms of the copies that survive today. So there's no problem, in my perspective, affirming that those are legitimate or using them when you're discussing doctrine and analyzing Scripture. I wouldn't cling to 1 John 5:7 because it's more controversial whether or not that phrase in the, known as the Johannine comma is there in the original. But that's just so that you don't try to prove something controversial with something else that's equally controversial.
Right.
But that's all I would say about those, really. They don't affect everything overall by any means. And, you know, sort of in closing here, I think our view, and I think the responsible view, is that Alexandrian texts are great because at least 85% of what's in them is consistent with everything else that we know. By and large, most of the wording differences in them are inconsequential, just accidents that are easily corrected and don't touch on doctrine. But we should regard them with reasonable skepticism when there's a potential for doctrinal impact in the wording difference found in an Alexandrian manuscript. You don't throw them out. You don't say they're all wrong. You don't say they're heretical documents. They're not. But we should be critical in our reasoning when we come to some of those. Generally, it may be safer to prefer the Byzantine manuscripts in that regard. But that's pretty much the sum total. We don't take an extreme point of view on either one of those, and I think that's probably a sufficient place to stop tonight's study.
Yeah. We'll get the prayer requests going.